Right. Well, this is a second oral history interview session with Jim Goldie taking place on April the 8th, 2005 in Allentown, Pennsylvania with David Brock and Christophe Lecouillet as the interviewers. And where we left off last time, we had left off at this transitional period for you right around 1961 when you became the head of Silicon Transistor and Integrated Circuit Department of the Bell Telephone Laboratories. Could you describe that change in role for you?
Yeah, it was really just a promotion to move up the very similar work in what had been my former group. The new supervisor, he then reported to me, as did several others, and so that was the PNPN group. And in addition, there was a Silicon Transistor group, mm-hmm. The beginnings of an Integrated Circuit group, and boy, I don't know, Ryan, what did he do? Maybe some technology, I can't remember all the, mm-hmm. But we were still, you know, developing devices for both new generic devices in some cases, and in other cases, specific for use in, or potential use in Bell System applications.
Mm-hmm. This was still in the development side,
yes,
of Bell Labs.
Very okay. Much so, yeah. Mm-hmm. During those 5 years or so I was there before transferring to Allentown, a number of kind of notable things happened, most of which I can't claim any credit for, but which occurred in the organization and may be worth mentioning. Probably the single most important one was I don't know whether we should say invention development, but of the epitaxial transistor,
okay.
Which was conceived by Ian Ross, who was my boss, and who later became president of Bell Labs.
Yeah.
And was carried out from the point of view of the device by Howard Lohr, one of the supervisors, and that made a big splash at that solid state device research conference, the June conference at Carnegie. And that's where I'm a little confused whether that was 60 or 61. It must have been 61. There was another piece of big news that year, which was coming out of Bell Labs, which got overshadowed by that, and it was out of the department too. And that was the invention, I think it was, by Duan Kong and John Atala of the what we then called the IGFET, for insulated gate field effect transistor,
right.
Commonly known as the MOS transistor.
Mm-hmm.
That was also in the department in a separate supervisory group. And there was also important work done on my old device, the PNPN, by Ian McIntosh on the three-terminal device, the triode. I think that, and we began our foray into integrated circuits during this five-year period.
Okay.
And we did some things which, looking back on, were pretty stupid, I guess.
In what sense?
Well, it goes... The whole idea in the Bell Labs at that time was the thing that really makes, the thing that really matters is performance, mm-hmm. which mainly is speed in our case. You know, high voltage wasn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. And as the work and of, you know, of the Fairchild guys, Bob Noyce and company, was going along, as was Jack Kilby down in Dallas. We saw Kilby's, the great, you know, great accomplishment for Jack, but we saw that as, we didn't see that as a viable commercial mm-hmm. thing. And we recognized that the planar technology and so forth mm-hmm. Would be, but we also knew it would never perform as fast because of the added parasitics mm-hmm. as maybe discrete devices. So we came up with this idea of multiple chip, as we called it, integrated circuits, where mm-hmm. and then putting them in a common package, one of the old TO-5, mm-hmm. I guess it was. Mm-hmm. And clearly we were wrong on that. But it did take up a substantial effort.
Mm-hmm. So was this a hybrid circuit?
No, this was before the hybrid circuits, because the thing, uh-huh. that thin film operation
yes.
was beginning
okay.
with
okay.
Henry Stone's people, Dave McLean, others, Charlie Goddard, Feldman. But those hybrid circuits became a reality mm-hmm. later in that time period,
okay.
which was also in that same time. Okay. The invention of the beam lead transistor, Marty Lepsalder
okay.
was the principal guy there. You know what I'm talking about? This was a device which the transistor originally, you know how you make a lot of them in the same wafer and then
right.
you mm-hmm. etch them apart. But there were beams, they called them. There's large contacts extending out from the device, mm-hmm. and then when you etch them apart, you turn them over, and then you could bond those to the hybrid circuit,
okay.
or to the thin film circuit, which made it a hybrid.
Okay.
And though that was not a real big deal in the industry, it was a fairly big deal in the Bell system, and found lots of applications. And things from telephones up to ESS. It was used in ESS. Was that 1A, I guess. Which was developed out of Indian Hill. The that whole hybrid technology. It's a little diversion, but it's important, I think. Was thought to be a major future technology for the Bell system, mm-hmm. and Jack Morton, who was our vice president and driving force behind much of this, mm-hmm. had set up what he called PCLs for Process Capability Laboratories, I think, mm-hmm. at Indianapolis, mm-hmm. which was not a device plant, but it was where they manufactured telephones. Where Western manufactured telephone. At Merrimack Valley, which was the main transmission plant, and at Lyell, which was the introduction to manufacturing for okay. ESS. It's right near Indian Hill. Uh-huh. If I'm saying things that you don't know what I'm talking about,
I will.
Stop me. But I'm No, you know an awful lot. and there was a Bell Labs department head at each of those locations,
okay.
and a few Bell Labs people. But most of the staff there uh-huh. were Western Electric engineers on loan. The whole idea was to ease the transition, design for manufacture into manufacture, and that technology remained important for a long time.
What characteristics did that hybrid circuit technology have, if you're comparing it to like a planar integrated circuit?
Well, the passive components, the resistors and the capacitors were tantalum based, and they were very precise. They could be controlled by anodization processes, and you could get, you know, a very good classical type component. Whereas, uh-huh, you know, the capacitors and resistors you make out of silicon aren't good standalone components, but obviously people have learned how to make good circuits with those. Uh-huh. That was for that, and on the active components, which initially certainly were maybe discrete transistors, again, had all the high performance. They were free of the parasitics that you get in the other. So that was, again, the drive to performance.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that many system houses made the same choice, right?
Yeah, they followed. Some followed our lead. That's
and
right.
CDC and all these chose that technology. I mean.
Yeah, there certainly were a number, and you know, they had their own conferences. I didn't go to many of their conferences, but the mainstream silicon company, you know, the TI, Fairchild, later Intel, didn't pick it up in any big way. TI maybe had a little bit, but I'm not even sure of that. I think nobody, you know, we knew we were in on something important and doing something important, but none of us, I don't think, foresaw, you know, what was really going to happen in the semiconductor business. Not at that time, not in the early 60s.
Right.
And so, you know, we were trying to, even though we always thought of ourselves as long-range thinkers and so forth, we were solving the problems of the next decade, not the next 25 years. Some people might take exception to that, but that's kind of the way I look at it.
I wanted to loop you back a little bit and just ask about some general features about the silicon transistor and IC department in this period.
Mm-hmm.
About just the general size in terms of the professional personnel, maybe.
Yeah, and by the way, we were part of what was called the Transistor Development Laboratory, I think.
Okay.
Which Ian Ross initially. Well, not initially, but when I was promoted, was the director, and then Jim Early became that. And there were other departments with different titles which were also doing quite similar work, but on different devices, but some microwave stuff. Okay. Jim Early was still involved in germanium transistors. The whole thing of Barney DeLoach and Company, the Viractors, and then later the Impet diodes. So that was all part of Ross's organization. As far as my department was concerned, there were four supervisory groups, and each supervisory group probably had 5 to 7 MTS, members of technical staff,
mm-hmm,
and an equivalent number of technicians, approximately one for one. So I guess the department was whatever that multiplies out to be.
50 people.
Yeah, 50, something like that. And most of the staff was, most of the staff were PhDs. Good sprinkling of Europeans, mm-hmm, particularly English, mm-hmm, and some Germans primarily. The rest tended to be Americans. A few Asians were coming in, but mm-hmm. not at the level that mm-hmm. we have today.
And each one of those supervisory groups, was their charge to really, those groups were device-centered, and it was to really, you know, develop a particular device?
In part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was the PNPN work, for example, which had been my old group. And,
right.
And I wonder if Brian Howard, when McIntosh did that work, he was not the supervisor. He later became a supervisor in Reading. But, you know, he was doing characterizing the device. He wrote a kind of a classic paper in the proceedings, you know, and the impact of the base current and how it affects all the other characteristics mm-hmm. and so forth. So there was the general work on advancing the technology and the device understanding of various classes of devices. But there was also some specific device work, development of a specific transistor, which would be, you know, working closely with what we call the systems people, you know, the people at mm-hmm. Indian Hill, which were probably still at Whippany at that time, they were. And I don't even remember whether it was the Homedale. There were a lot of systems areas in Murray Hill at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But yes. Most of what we called final development and the specific design and the hammering out of detailed characteristics and negotiating those with Western in a way that they could make, that was done by the people in Allentown.
I see.
Reading sometime in that period got a start too, but initially as a developer on the lab side and was called Laureldale and then at that time it was a little for military work.
Mm-hmm.
Military work, most of it in the Bell system. The Whippany at that time was primarily, you know, they were involved in Nike and Underwater Sound and mm-hmm. various defense systems.
Right.
So there's something. Yeah, there was other work, of course, going on in not in my organization so much, but the Jim Early continued his work on the germanium transistors and other high speed devices, and they saw use, I think, in military systems. I'm a little foggy on that,
mm-hmm.
but you know, it was pretty well recognized because, of course, back to this old question of performance, you know, germanium outperformed silicon because of the higher mobilities, but the silicon technology, because of the oxides and all that kind of stuff, we recognized that, you know, the future of the world was clearly in silicon,
mm-hmm.
and that's where the effort was. But
right.
There were still one or two groups doing germanium. Mm-hmm. We also had a group. In fact, Atala was the supervisor, and Atala and Kong, Duan Kong, where out of which came that MOS transistor.
Mm-hmm.
They were primarily trying to understand how to passivate the surfaces, mm-hmm. Because it was well recognized then. By then, that the package, the TO5 and the successor packages and hermetically sealed and all that kind of stuff, that there was an awful lot of cost in that.
Mm-hmm.
So the goal was set fairly early on by Jack Morton, mm-hmm. you know, if we could just get these surfaces passivated. And of course, we knew some things from the oxide work already that there
right.
was some passivation there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what Atala and Kong's group were really, Atala's group, I should say, were really working on. Mm-hmm. But they came up with the MOS. I don't even remember now whether, since those guys at that time, even though they're in our department, didn't really, and they would probably be offended by this, so I better, but I don't think they understood devices at the detailed level that many of the other people. Okay. They were focusing on the chemistry of the oxide surface and so on.
Right.
But of course, the you know, there was a major breakthrough in understanding of what was causing the failure at Fairchild, and that was Andy Grove and Bruce Deal and Ed Snow. The big break that came, I was still at Murray Hill, and it which really did lead to devices which would be adequate for Bell System and even for military application, came with the development of silicon nitride, which was done in the Allentown lab. And it was interesting that they were well ahead of Murray Hill on that. There's an interesting story. You might ask Gordon and may if he remembers it. But the history of the silicon nitride thing, there was a paper given by IBM at the PGED conference in Washington. And I was sitting next to Gordon there, and we were chatting about it afterwards. Said it sounded kind of good and so forth. They were talking about the masking, and I think they talked a little bit about it kept the sodium out. But Gordon said, you know, Jim, he says, probably not worth much because that's the only time IBM talks about something. Now, don't you ask him if he remembers it? Because I don't want to. I don't want to lose a friend over the statement. But I
excuse me. Stop this.